I said, on, you know, some days I want to leave. Some days I just want to take on the whole business and make it my own and prove that I can do it. And he asked me, well, on your good days, what do you know to be true? And I said, I need to leave the business. Hmm. Like, it's time. There's other work that I'm here to do, and I don't know what that is yet, and that scares me. Mm-hmm. But if I don't make room, I'll never, right? You make room and the universe fills it. And if I don't make room and let go of this thing, I'll never know what could be.
Hello, and welcome to Overshare, a podcast where we have honest conversations with creative people we admire about the struggles that often come along with being a creative professional. In a world of carefully curated portfolio sites and Instagram feeds, we try to get past those highlights and discuss the tough stuff we don't talk about in public often enough. In this episode, you will learn how to pick yourself back up in difficult times and create a life from the inside out based on what's important to you instead of reacting to outside pressures and expectations. I'm your host, Justin Genak, and I'm also the co-founder of Working Networking, a curated community that connects companies with the universe's most respected, most awarded, and hardest working creatives in advertising, design, production, and tech. We really appreciate everyone who supported us so far. So if you enjoy Overshare and have gotten anything out of it, please take a minute to rate and review us. It goes a long way in helping other people discover the podcast. Also, you can subscribe to get new episodes and they're released every 2 weeks. And if you're digging it, please send us a note on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook at Overshare Talks. We'd really love to hear from you. This is a deeply personal and intimate in-studio conversation with my friend Tina Assmaker about loss, divorce, resiliency, and new beginnings. Tina spent over a decade working as a social worker helping runaway and homeless teens in her home state of Michigan, and then went on to interview over 250 artists, makers, and risk takers as co-founder and editor-in-chief of The Great Discontent. Tina is now embarking on a new chapter in her career as a coach, speaker, and writer. She's been incredibly honest and vulnerable about the challenges that have come from her decade-long marriage ending on the eve of Trump's inauguration, and also the gifts that have come from reassessing every aspect of her life and her priorities in the aftermath. I've been so inspired by Tina through this journey. Whenever I read her writing, whether it's a Medium post or her Vice column, Asking Not Asking on the Working Not Working magazine, I'm always touched by her sincerity and relatability. It feels like she's walking 50 feet ahead in the forest and shouting out all the obstacles for me. I especially love her perspective on her divorce, that things didn't fall apart, they fell together. This was a therapeutic hour for both of us, and very likely for you as well, so please enjoy my conversation with Tina Assmaker.
Really hard questions. How are you?
I'm good.
Good?
It's feeling not good. Super early, which is nice because I'm not a morning person.
No, neither am I. At all. I don't know how people do that.
I don't know. I keep waiting, you know, I'm 37 now, and I keep waiting to become a morning person because I think I might get more things done, but it's just not happening.
I have like once a year where I wake up super early, and I'm like, oh,
yeah, it's
wow.
Christmas, right?
Yeah.
Or like day one of your vacation, you wake up so excited to go somewhere.
Yeah. Otherwise, like I think that the key is going to bed early, and then you can wake up early.
Yeah.
But I don't do
that. I'm not good at that either.
No, I'm not good at that. I found that I have a thing called sleep procrastination, is a real thing.
Mm.
I self-diagnosed and I don't feel as bad about it anymore. all right. Favorite curse word.
Oh, I don't.
Do you curse?
Probably fuck.
Fuck? Okay. Yeah. All right.
Is this a lightning round?
Yeah,
this is a nice and easy warm-ups.
Yeah. Do you prefer being interviewed or interviewing someone else?
I prefer interviewing others, but I'm happy to switch roles today.
Okay, good. I like being interviewed because it feels like less work. You just show up. Yeah. But then you actually have to talk about yourself. So
yeah,
I guess it's a whole thing. All right. So we're going to go to the background. Where are you from originally?
Michigan.
Michigan. Okay. Whereabouts?
Well, you guys can't see me because I'm...
You're doing the mitt.
I'm doing the mitt. But southeastern Michigan, a small town of about 30,000 people called Port Huron. It's the boyhood home of Thomas Edison.
Oh, that's cool.
And it's about an hour from Detroit. I think you guys have all heard of that.
Yeah, I've heard of that one. Yep. I've been to the D. And did you grow up in a creative household?
No, I grew up, well, yes and no. So my parents didn't do creative work for a living. And most of my family, you know, it's very blue collar. There's a lot of factory work. My dad worked in a factory when I was younger and did a lot of manual labor jobs. My mom was a stay-at-home mom.
Mm-hmm.
But I did grow up in a household where creativity was encouraged. So anytime I had a school project, it was You know, let's sit down together. We'll make it the best it can be.
That's great.
And, you know, I was always drawing and painting, and my parents would buy me whatever I needed to do to make artwork.
Yeah, so they were super supportive of that. That's great. And did you have siblings?
Yes, I have a twin brother.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, who's older?
You didn't do your research.
Well.
Well, he was born first, about 15 minutes before me. My parents actually didn't know they were having twins. They didn't want...
Whoa.
They just wanted to have a healthy baby. And so I you know, have journals that my mother wrote in when she was pregnant up until the time we started walking and she didn't have time anymore to write. And so it's like, baby, we're so excited to meet you. And then it's... Babies, there are two of you.
How often does that happen where it's like, surprise?
I don't know.
You have a daughter in here too. She's just hanging out.
Surprise, I'm here. So that's how I came into the world. Surprise. And
that's incredible.
Yeah.
What kind of doctor couldn't spot that one?
Well, I don't know what the technology was like back then, but you know, people opt today to not like find out the sex, right?
Yeah,
they don't
want
to know. I mean, I really have no idea. I don't know what the doctor was doing at the appointments.
That's incredible. Are you and your brother close now or?
Yeah. So my brother actually, this is like a bit of a, I don't know how, if you want me to get into the story, but so my brother is developmentally disabled, which means he's on the spectrum. Okay. And so my dad's his guardian, and one day I'll be his guardian. Mm-hmm. And so we are very close, but he's often felt like a younger brother. You know, I've been very protective of him from a young age. Yeah. But he has taught me so much about life. There's just this innocence about him. Like, for example, he loves to ride his bike around the neighborhood, and he knows all of the neighbors. And his bike was getting very, you know, it was very well worn. Mm-hmm. And so this was when I was living in Michigan. I was at Target one day, as you do. There was a bike on sale. I bought it for him, went home. He was out on his old tattered bike. I put his new bike in his room, and I said, when he got home, I said, Gary, go look in your room. And he went in his room, and he screams out of his room, Dad, someone's bike is in my room, because he thought that
someone's
bike was in his room. Uh-huh. It was so innocent. Like, he didn't want to touch it. He didn't want to do anything with it. And I said, no, it's your bike. Take it for a ride. So he took it out and he came back and he's like, it rides real nice. But just such innocence. And
just a different way of looking at things.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, that's good. That's got to give you some nice perspective.
Yeah, definitely.
That's cool. And where did you go to school?
For what, elementary, middle, high school, college, the whole
deal? Oh, that's what you grew up there. And then where'd you go to college?
I went to community college to start. Okay. I didn't, you know, at 18, you're supposed to know what you want to do, and no one does. I had a lot of friends who went away to colleges, spent a lot of money. I didn't grow up with, you know, there was no college fund.
Yeah.
There was no family money. It was, I pay it myself and by working, or I take out a loan, and I didn't want to go into major debt. And so I went to community college. I applied for, you know, I got a Pell Grant, which is a need-based grant. Yep. I got a scholarship on, I actually wanted to study art, and I had a little portfolio from my high school art class. And so I got a little scholarship for that, and I cobbled money together. I also worked. I've been working since I was 16 and had a car and could drive myself to work. And so I went to community college. I thought I was going to major in fine art, and, you know, took a lot of classes. And then at 18, I started working at a shelter for runaway and homeless youth in my community. And I saw the social workers there, or the counselors there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I really love people, but I also love creativity, and I just couldn't figure out how to put those two pieces of the puzzle together. And I also wasn't sure what I would do with art, and I knew I needed to make some kind of money, right? Because I didn't have a safety net.
Yeah.
No one told me you don't make money doing social work, but maybe.
This seems promising. Yeah.
This seems a little more secure. So anyway, I went to community college for like, oh gosh, I don't know, 5 years, because I changed my major from fine art to social work. And then I had prereqs that I had to do. So I transferred to the social work program at Wayne State University, which really has an outstanding program. And I got a wonderful education and learned so much from my professors. And throughout that time, I worked at the same nonprofit, the emergency shelter. And then I graduated and moved to the transitional living program, which is residential.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then how long were you doing social work for?
I was doing that for, well, I was at the same nonprofit for a total of 12 years, but it was 6 years while I was in college, and then as a direct care worker. And then once I graduated, I moved over to like a more clinical role, because I had the
credentials.
The credentials, yeah.
Yeah. And then what was that like on your day-to-day in that role?
Well, I think everything that I have done since then draws on that experience. Working with young, like teenagers are my probably my favorite age group. I always joke that if I have children, like babies, I'm not sure what to do with them. I'll figure it out. I guess you figure it out when it's your own child, right? But teenagers, I love them. Give me all your teenagers. Because they are, you know, they are like little sponges. They don't need you at all, but they want you sometimes, and you have to pretend that you don't want them to want you. But no, I was working with young people and their families. And, you know, a lot of times they came to us in crisis. They were either homeless or they were going to be homeless. There might have been domestic violence issues. There might have been substance abuse issues. So it was really about meeting them wherever they were at, figuring out what resources they had available to them, talking to them about where they wanted to go with their life, and then helping them gather the resources and providing the support for them to move from where they are or mm-hmm. where they were to where they wanted to be in their life. And that took, you know, work on my part, and it took work on their part. It was really a partnership, and it was some of the most rewarding work I've ever done, and definitely the hardest work I've ever done.
Well, it's got to be really hard to probably not get so emotionally involved with it mm-hmm. because these are so vulnerable and innocent mm-hmm. people at such a hard point. And then like, how do you not want to go and like save everybody you encounter?
Yeah, no, you want to, and that's the problem. You know, you can't just punch out at night and be like, oh yeah, that design work that I did, it's not finished, but I'll just get to it tomorrow. This is a human life. And sometimes I would leave a shift and a young person would be, you know, having a crisis that day, and I would think about it. Or maybe I would get a phone call later that night, right? Because I was on call as a clinician,
right.
And maybe, you know, the staff needed my support. So it was really, really hard to shut it off. And I think even though I only did it for 6 years post-degree, I think I was already starting to burn out. There was a point where I did a lot of community organizing as well on behalf of my agency. And so I was at a meeting with a fellow social worker who had been planning to retire but had to push her retirement back. And she was just at her wit's end. And she didn't work for my organization. She worked for a different one. She looked at me in the middle of this meeting and she said, "Is there anything else in the world that you like to do besides social work?" And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "Do it now. Don't wait until you're old like me and you have no other options." And that stuck with me because it was, you know, first of all, it was disheartening. Mm-hmm. But there was also so much truth in it because I had always wanted to do something creative mm-hmm. and I just didn't know how because I didn't have anyone model that path for me growing up.
And so then how did you go from, was that like that meeting you walked out and you're like, "Well, I'm out. See you
I'm
guys."
Out. Yeah. No, I actually don't know how much longer it was after that, but you know, I was doing social work for 6 years post-degree, and you know, when you're in the place where you think something has to happen, but you don't know what, mm-hmm. and you're waiting for an opportunity to come to you, you're waiting for someone else to give you permission or tell you what to do, and then you think, oh, maybe if I quit my job, maybe if I move, mm-hmm. maybe if I make a really big life change, then I can have what I want. And I reached this point, you know, at the time I was married, and, you know, my former husband and I reached a point where we realized that what needed to change was us, and we couldn't look to anything external. And so what had happened was we read The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield, which is a really, really wonderful book, very easy to read, and it will kick your ass in an incredible way.
Okay.
And the book talks a lot about this idea of resistance and that we have to push past resistance. And so my former husband, Brian, at the time had his own web and design studio. He worked from home. I was doing social work. I worked from an office. When you're in a relationship, you can sabotage yourself, but you can also sabotage each other, right? You get done at the end of the day and you just want to chill, watch TV, have a couple beers, veg out. And we realized that we had to physically change our environment to change our behaviors. So we turned our living room into a working studio, and we had this really great leather sectional, which someone had given us. We gave that away. We got rid of the TV, coffee table, anything that that indicated
just
lounging.
Sucked into, yeah.
That's right.
It's so easy to do that.
It's
yeah.
so easy. So we literally had nowhere to sit and chill and watch TV. And so he had half the studio. I had half the studio. And in the evening, we would sit. We were in Michigan, so we had space. We had an outside. We had a deck. We would sit outside and talk about creative ideas that we wanted to work on together. Because that had always been the dream. And a magazine was always at the top of the list. We didn't know how to do print. And so we started with what we knew, which was web.
Yeah, because that was his forte. Yeah. And that makes sense.
Exactly.
It's amazing what happens, what conversations can happen when you're not sitting on the couch watching TV or Netflix. Because mm-hmm. you're forced to engage each other, which is, it's really easy to ignore each other when you get into that need to want to, the routine to veg.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, decompress. Yeah,
it's great to watch TV once in a while,
yeah,
right? Like,
sure.
But there's no meaningful conversation or interaction.
Yeah, and so you force that conversation, that interaction, and then you guys said, "All right, well, what are we gonna do? Let's start an online magazine."
Yeah. Should I go into that a little bit? I don't know. I don't know if I'm leaping ahead on your questions, but
wherever we want to go.
Yeah, we just started brainstorming. Thought about a magazine, and I think it really spoke to where we were at the time. I can speak for myself in that I was really frustrated. Work was burning me out quickly. I wasn't really taking care of myself or doing anything for myself as a creative outlet, and I didn't know how to get there. And so the idea for the magazine was, well, if we could talk to people who have done creative work for a living or who are doing creative work for a living and interview them and ask them about their path, it's research, right? Maybe we can figure out how to do it for ourselves. And, the name came out of something a mentor said to Ryan, that you have to learn to be content in your discontent, because it's always going to be there, right? We are always going to be restless. We'll always metabolize everything, every experience, every accolade, right? If you're living for those things, you will metabolize and you'll be disappointed. So you're going to be restless. That's okay. You can be content in that. And so the great, I can't remember. We can't remember who actually came up with the name, but it was in the notes that I had written down. The great discontent. Let's embrace that and start hatching it out. And so Ryan, he designed the site, and I did the, the editorial. We did a lot of the interviewing together in the beginning because we really just wanted to meet these people who we respected and have conversations with them.
And you were still living in Michigan at the time.
Yeah, we were still living in Michigan. So the magazine launched online in August 2011. We were still living in Michigan until the following spring. We moved to New York on April 1st, 2012. So April Fool's Day. Uh-huh. And it was really great to start something. When you start something where you are, you realize that you really have no excuses, that you are standing in your own way and you just need to get out.
Yeah. Like anything's possible. And especially with the internet, it's like, even if you didn't have the skills or the background to be able to make your own website, there's so many tools where you could just go and put something out there. So it's all there. And you guys just finally took a hold of it and made it happen.
Yep.
Who was the first interview?
It was Dan Rubin, who at the time was really, we reached out. There was Twitter was different, in 2011.
Yeah.
It was a very tight-knit design community. And so we reached out just starting with people we knew. And so Dan Rubin was in the design community. He now actually, I think, is mainly focused on photography. He's a really incredible photographer. But that was the first. And then the second interview was Francesca Talone, who's a photographer based in Canada. The third was Lisa Solberg, who's a fine artist based in LA. And then, we went on from there. So from the beginning, we had a diverse group of people. It wasn't just design, although people often thought it was just designers. But
And did you have a background in writing up until that point? Or was that just kind of something you just dove into and you're like, oh, I'll figure this out?
I became a writer because I started writing, and I've always loved English class. Was always my favorite. I'm obsessed with grammar and punctuation, and I always wanted, since I was a little girl, I wanted to be a writer. I just didn't know how to be a writer, but turns out you just have to start writing. And so I became known as a writer and editor because I was doing the work. And it was awful. I can't go back and read the first interviews that we put out online, because it's just, I'm like, who edited this? Me. But I had wonderful people who gave me input on you know, styles and approaches as an editor, and I learned from them and just got better as I went along.
Yeah, and I also like that you started it to serve a need for yourself. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's even like with starting this podcast. I always joke that it's like just therapy for me.
Yeah,
but you,
no, it is.
It is. It's like you learn so much from other people, and forcing yourself into the habit of having these conversations mm-hmm. is so beneficial.
Yeah.
And how often were you guys producing content for it?
So we did a new interview every Tuesday.
Okay.
And so that's, I mean, that was initially, we did that for quite a long time, and then started to diversify content, right? So did a Kickstarter for a print issue, and then...
I back that.
Yeah, thank you. And then did print issues, and then diversified into a live event series and podcast, and all of that happened after we moved to New York.
Yeah. And then from the start, it seemed like you guys had a really good reputation. It was beautifully designed. The writing mm-hmm. was really great. How long did it take before you started seeing some traction and the word getting out about it?
Well, I think, you know, it happened very organically. We obviously didn't have a marketing budget, and we didn't, you know, it was just the two of us. So we wore many different hats. I mean, I think in the first like 3 to 6 months, really, you know, the design of it was you know, future leaning at the time. Yeah. There were not a lot of sites that looked like TGD looked.
Yeah.
And, you know, just the fact that it was very simple. It's the landing page is the interview that is featured that week. And it's a long form interview. And we said, you know, fuck it. If people can take time to, you know, do movie marathons and read very long books, then they can read long content on the web. And that's when long form content, you know, was starting to have this rebirth. And
yeah.
So it was, you know, it was a matter of, I think the timing was right. And, you know, I think about if it was launched today, would it have the same response? And I just don't know. But it was what I needed at the time. It was what we wanted to work on. And the timing just happened to work with the online community and where people were at and what they were hungry for.
And it definitely cut through, too. There's like, it seemed like you had beautiful photography every interview, too. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it was all original photography each time or it just like you were like big, beautiful images. Filled the screen, mm-hmm. and then you had like really clean design, and mm-hmm. it was like, yeah, it was really great.
Yeah.
And how long did you do that for?
I did that for, let's see, six years. Oh my gosh, I'm like,
yeah.
You know, you reach the point where you're like, how old am I, and how long have I been doing all these things?
Yeah, and you're just like, okay, yeah.
Yeah, 6 years.
6 years. And do you have any favorite interviews that stand
out?
Oh,
of course I do. You know, so all of the writers, right? Like Sheila Hetty. I interviewed Cheryl Strayed right as Wild had become a New York Times bestseller.
Wow.
I had somehow gotten contact with her book agent, and I was living in East Village at the time. I think I had moved just a few months prior from Michigan to New York. And so I'm on a Skype video chat with Cheryl Strayed. She has a glass of wine. I have a glass of wine. And I spent a whole hour talking to this woman who, you know, there are some parallels, right? Like mm-hmm. her mother passed away when she was in her late teens, early 20s. My mother passed away when I was 10. I was a lot younger. But, you know, there's these similar themes of loss and grief and rebirth, and how do you make a life, you know, how do you go through hard things and what makes us resilient? And I just admire her so much. And so having that time, you know, it felt really selfish to want that. But I got it. It was amazing. And then I got to meet her. I think it was a month or two later, she was doing a book signing at the Barnes & Noble in Union Square, and I got to meet her and her agent, and they both remembered me and got to give her a big hug and take a picture, and it was just a really incredible moment.
Yeah, it's nice when you put the work in and you do something that you're really proud of, and it gets you to the point to be able to start having these conversations that maybe you wouldn't have expected to be able to mm-hmm. get to at a certain point, and that's got to feel really good.
Yeah, it does.
And so then you stopped working on The Great Discontent last year.
I did.
Do we want to talk about why? Or
Oh, yeah, of course. This is Overshare. We'll share everything.
Okay.
So it was actually, it's 2018. It was actually, it's been a year already. So, yeah, so, you know, life happens. And after, you know, a decade of marriage, so married for 5 years and then started The Great Discontent and did that for 5 years. So half of our marriage, we work together. It's very, very hard to work with a partner. That's probably maybe yeah. another episode. It's
just talking about that. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Right. It's the dream for many people and it can be amazing. And I had, you know, we created something really beautiful and really special and this amazing community came out of it. But yeah, after a decade of marriage, my marriage ended and, the Great Discontent was such a representation of our partnership. And our marriage and our partnership, our personal partnership, yeah. was this really attractive narrative that people liked. They liked that it was part of the story of the Great Discontent.
Yeah.
And I didn't know how to continue working on the Great Discontent and separate myself from that narrative. And so I knew that it was time for me to transition into something else. And I wasn't sure what that would be. It was January 2017, actually the evening before Trump's inauguration.
Yeah.
So my marriage ended and everyone woke up in the morning and, you know, they were really sad about the news and Trump. And I was really sad because my marriage had ended and I knew that was going to affect the business and just everything. Right. So we had the same friends. We worked together, lived together our whole lives.
We're intertwined. Yeah.
We're enmeshed. And so we made a transition plan. It was really, really challenging to silo personal and business, but we did our best. I think we did a great job. And we said, we want the business to continue. And so what does that look like? And so he agreed to helm the business and mm-hmm. continue leading TGD. And I said, well, I can stay on and, you know, complete my commitments for... It ended up being a whole year that we worked together because I was hosting the live show and we had some other commitments. And that summer, I hired a new editor, managing editor, who replaced me. It's really wonderful, does great work, and is still working today on the magazine. And then
it's got to be reassuring then to know that it's in good hands. And
yeah,
it's gonna
exactly.
continue on.
You know, I mean, we created this really, you know, I'm so proud of the work I did with The Great Discontent and what we created. And I didn't, you know, part of me, of course, you know, I was, when you're in pain, all you want to do is get out of pain. And all I wanted to do was just, I wanted to walk away.
Yeah.
I wanted to walk away from everything because it just felt overwhelming at times. And I still look back and think, how did you work with your partner for a year while you were going through the process of mediation and divorce?
Yeah.
I don't know. I really don't know where I found the strength, but I know that I'm very resilient and somehow I found the strength. And last December I hosted my last live show and, you know, that was the finale. And that was, the last thing that I had committed to that I needed to complete, and I did. And then, in the meantime, I really wasn't sure what was next.
Yeah.
And I had been doing some freelance work to pay the bills, and I wanted to give myself some space to figure out what was next because I knew that if I could hang out in that liminal space long enough, I would figure it out.
Yeah.
And so I got, I moved a block away into a new apartment with a roommate. I've never had
only a block away.
A block away.
Very close.
My friends, my friends came over and literally helped me move down the street. It was amazing. Oh, so I didn't have to hire movers, right?
Yeah.
I found this amazing apartment. I named it Oasis because it really was such a place of quiet and healing. And I did some freelance work and I started getting invitations to speak, which I did, and
which has got to be hard to do at that point in mm-hmm, your life, mm-hmm. like going through what you're going through. And I know I saw your talk from the AIGA conference, mm-hmm. And like we only met earlier this year, and it was because I'm going through a separation,
mm-hmm.
and some friends of mine said, "Well, do you know Tina?" And mm-hmm. I was like, "Well, yeah, I know of Tina." And they're like, "Well, have you seen what she's been writing?" And you were at the point where I think you were just starting to write about the experience mm-hmm. and put it out there. And then you gave a talk about vulnerability and what you've been going through. And I just connected so much with it. And it was like, and that's like really hard to do.
Yeah.
That's really, it takes a lot of courage to be able to go like, here's all of the shit that I'm going through.
Yeah.
Now.
So what had happened was in December, 2016, Julie Anixter, who was the, you know, with a president or director of AIGA at the time, asked me to chair the AIGA National Conference. And I said, yes. Well, in January, my marriage ended and I thought, I can't do anything. I don't. And I remember I was staying at Debbie Millman's. She's been, you know, a good friend and mentor and advisor to me. And I was at her kitchen table and she came downstairs and I just said, Debbie, I can't chair this conference. And she said, you are chairing this conference. They want you. They asked you. It is, you know, it was at that point, maybe it was February. Yeah. She said, it's February. The conference is in October. You are going to be in a very different spot. Trust me. You're going to do it. And I just thought, well, I can't say no to Debbie Millman. So, so I planned. What happened was I needed to give myself some privacy and space. So I didn't talk about my divorce publicly. Mm-hmm. And I did do some speaking, but I didn't disclose what was going on at the time. And so
it's too new and too fresh.
It's too new. You also don't know how you feel about it, right? Yeah. You're still processing. So I had some close friends who I call my divorce sponsors, right? When I wanted to chug a bottle of vodka or, which I don't even drink vodka. That's weird.
or wine. Yeah.
Or maybe send a really angry email or, right. I would go down the list and contact my divorce sponsors and whoever could hop on the phone with me first, we would take the call and they would talk
that's
me down from the
concept.
Ledge. It was amazing.
Yeah.
And so I was doing a lot of processing and of course therapy and all that self-care, but publicly I needed to give myself some space. And so it was, I planned the whole conference and the conference was in October and it was in August where I finally said, I'm ready to share publicly what I've gone through in a way where, it's my story and I get to tell it, but in a respectful way, right? Because
That's the balance.
Yeah, it's the balance, right? But I also wanted to be able to live wholeheartedly, and that means being the same person in every space that I occupy and not having to compartmentalize my story. And so because I had a public image online and on social media, I needed to be able to be the same person online as I was in my private life.
But that would be too hard not to.
It's too hard.
To feel insincere mm-hmm. in one aspect of your life, but not the other.
Yeah, yeah. I don't want to hide. I'm done hiding.
Yeah.
And so, in August, I shared online and just got a huge wave of support and people saying, me too, I've mm-hmm. gone through this. And then in October was the AIGA conference, where as chair, I had 10 minutes to kind of kick off the conference and set the tone. And I shared from the stage about my experience and, in the transition and in the divorce, and it was profound. It felt like a coming out in many ways. This is who I am and this is my life now. And so, it felt good. Actually, it felt quite freeing.
I've watched that talk twice now. and it was almost seeing someone else talk about something that you're going through is gave me permission also mm-hmm. to feel it. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think there was a really nice thing that applies to everything, not even just going through divorce, but you had a quote up there that was about empathy invites others to open up. Vulnerability says I'll go first,
mm-hmm.
Which was such a beautiful thought. And it's, I think something that I've been trying to do more of
mm-hmm.
In the past couple of years. I always joke on here that I didn't feel feelings for 36 years. And it's only to the past few years that I've started feeling them. And it's a whole new thing once you start to really understand who you are and what you're going through. Because mm-hmm. I think it's really easy to distract ourselves from our feelings, distract ourselves from our pain. I had a realization a few months ago that nobody goes through life unscathed. And we do everything we can to avoid the pain. But it's unavoidable.
Mm-hmm.
And so that resistance that you were talking about, to try to resist that pain, try to resist the struggle is just, it's impossible.
Yeah.
And so then finally just going I'm going to go through some shit and how am I going to roll with it is it almost prepares you for that. And it's going through stuff now, it's prepared me. Mm-hmm. And it just feels more empowering than trying to avoid being a victim of something.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Because then you know, resisting just prolongs our own pain and suffering. And when you say, okay, this is part of life, this is part of my story, it's not what I wanted, but how am I going to choose to respond?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you're no longer a victim. You are choosing how to respond. And also when you reach a certain age, you realize that everyone goes through things in life.
Yeah.
So not alone.
Well, and I think it's when you start talking about that stuff, you see that other people go through it. Because I think I always felt for a long time, felt the need to keep up a confidence or an image, mm-hmm. right, of having it together or being funny or having success and all of this shit. And then when you start talking about the stuff that you're going through, other people go, oh, yeah, like you're saying, like, oh, yeah, I've gone through that too. And I found that people that I was casual acquaintances with have become very close friends because mm-hmm. we've bonded over those experiences. And then you just have this support system now that maybe wouldn't have existed when you were just, you know, making jokes and having good times with people all the time.
Same. I have really, really close girlfriends and guy friends right now that I was... we were more acquaintances, you know. You see people around New York and what happened when things fell apart or fell together, as I now like to say, is that I reached out to people and it was an act of vulnerability. I remember texting Debbie Millman, you know, I wasn't super close with her, but I knew something in me said, text Debbie, she will know what to do. And so I texted her and I just said, hey, I'm going through some shit. Can we hop on the phone? And she said, how about today at 3:30? And I was so nervous. I think my heart was like pounding and got on the phone and I just said, this is what's going on. And every time I did that, it was like forcing myself to speak it and say, my marriage is ending. I'm getting divorced. That made it real. And there was something about saying it that was so hard, but it meant I couldn't live in the fantasy of maybe it's not happening. And that meant I had to get my shit together and I had to take ownership of everything in my life, right? Like my job, my money, where was I going to live? Who was I going to be? All of that. Like no one could do that for me. No one could manage that for me now.
Yeah. And that's it becomes... At times when you feel the most wanting to give up, it becomes the most... potentially the most empowering because you're like, oh, I'm in control of this and I can make the decisions. And I think there's something really nice. And there's something really freeing also of not trying to hide in the shame and carry that around because that weight becomes so much, you know. I can imagine, like I just know a lot of us so closely associate our identity with the work that we do. And it seems like that your identity was so closely tied to the Great Discontent for so long. How do you transition from something that you're like, this is who I am, to getting past that concept and being able to let go of something like that?
That was a challenge. You know, I knew deep down that I needed to transition out of TGD, but I remember having a phone call with a mentor who is like a father to me. And I said, some days I want to leave. Some days I just want to take on the whole business and make it my own and prove that I can do it. And he asked me, well, on your good days, what do you know to be true? And I said, I need to leave the business. Like it's time. There's other work that I'm here to do. And I don't know what that is yet. And that scares me. Mm-hmm. But if I don't make room, I'll never, right? You make room and the universe fills it. And if I don't make room and let go of this thing, I'll never know what could be.
Yeah, that got me. it's funny because I was telling you this earlier that Adam always jokes, my co-founder, who's going to cry first on Overshare, me or my guest. And he always puts on me. I didn't cry, but it got me. Yeah, okay. Let's see what else we got here. Well, I think there's also this idea of trying to, I found, and I see it even just in talking to friends, this want or need to force fit the life we expected to be living now with the life that we actually have and that tension that comes with it. Like, it seems like you've maybe gotten beyond that. Like, what was the key to getting past that?
Oh, I mean, I'm still in process. Look, I was 35? No. I can't remember. I think I was 36, mid-30s. You know, I didn't expect to, you know, I felt like when you get divorced, you feel like a failure.
For sure.
Especially as a woman, maybe the messaging is different for men. I felt like I didn't do enough. And I had done plenty. I had done so much. But, you know, sometimes you reach a point where it's just not working. And I felt like a failure. And then that was going to affect my business. I mean, I felt like my whole life was blowing up in my face. And then on top of that, I had no money. You know, I left my marriage with $4,000, which I used to get a new apartment in Ridgewood, Queens.
Yeah.
Guys, it's like not glamorous at all. Yeah. But I just, I don't know. I knew it would be okay. And I didn't know how, but I just had faith that it would be, because what else can you do in that moment?
Yeah.
Right?
You can, well, you can give up, but that doesn't do you any good.
You can.
You have to survive.
You can give up, but.
Well, and it's probably, you've had training and resilience, mm-hmm. either from, you know, losing your mother, mm-hmm. through dealing with, you know, children going through crisis as a social worker. Mm-hmm. So it's like you've had the pedigree to be able to pull that off, yeah. and maybe you just didn't realize it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think what I was doing for myself when my marriage ended was, you know, all of the case management and work that I did through social work, mm-hmm. I was doing all of that for myself. I was like, okay, girl, get out a pad of paper and make a list. Like, what do you gotta do? You gotta hire an attorney. You gotta figure out where you're gonna live. You have to, you know, all these things. It's like all these really practical things. And then I worked it. And then in addition to tackling my practical to-do list, it was like, okay, you got to go to therapy. You got to start working out, because uh-huh. you have not been taking care of yourself. You got to eat better, stop drinking all the time, right? You got to do all these things.
That's, well, and it becomes easy when you break it down like that, but then that can also become super overwhelming.
Oh, of course. That's yeah. why you need people. You know, yeah. I did not do this alone. I had, yeah. as I say, I had my divorce sponsors. I had my therapist. I had family. I had so many people. So you cannot do it alone. You need support.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that helps. So then you're on your own. You've got a roommate. Mm-hmm. You don't know how you're going to make money. So what did you start doing?
Well, on my to-do list for months, probably for 6 months, I had an item that said, look into life coaching. And I was procrastinating on it. Mm-hmm. And I was doing freelance work. I was actually doing some freelance work with Debbie Millman at the School of Visual Arts, which was incredible because they have an amazing program. And, you know, I loved doing that, but I knew it wouldn't be a forever thing. It was transitional. Right. And so I was like, oh, I got to look into this life coaching thing. And people had told me, you know, in the app.
And where did that come from? The want to do that?
Yeah. I think, you know, I really missed the direct impact that I had when I was doing social work, but I didn't want to do social work.
Yeah.
And I really loved doing the magazine, doing The Great Discontent, because I was putting a lot of inspiration out into the world. But the frustrating piece for me was that there were a lot of readers and people in our audience that would say, I have this idea, I'm inspired, but I don't know what to do next.
Yeah.
And so I thought,
so common.
How can I have a direct impact with the community I love, which is the creative community? And I had people tell me, as I began to open up to my friends and be vulnerable, they were like, wow, this is a whole other side of you I've never known.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew it was there.
Did you feel like for the past, you know, 20, 30 years, were you not vulnerable at all? Were you like closed off?
No, I think it was more since I had moved to New York. But even before then, it's, you know, it's hard when you experience a lot of grief and loss early on, right? It was easier for me often to let other people open up to me,
right.
and I would stay closed.
Yeah.
So it was very one way. So when it became two way, people saw this other side of me. They said, you could be a great counselor or therapist, but I didn't want to go back to school and spend a lot of time and money
yeah.
training. And I already had the social work degree and background. And so I knew that was a great foundation for me. And so I was at a party, in East Village, and a friend said to me, hey, I've been working with a life coach and he's really great, except for he doesn't exactly understand the creative landscape. And I said, I understand the creative world. I've been interviewing creatives for the last 6 years. I think there's something here. And so literally the next week I looked up coaching programs online. I signed up for a program in Atlanta that was in person and accelerated so that I could get to work as soon as possible.
Yeah.
A month later, I flew to Atlanta. I did the coach training, got certified, and opened my practice right from there. My facilitator said, don't wait, just start coaching people. You have plenty of experience and knowledge from a lifetime of learning.
Yeah.
And now you have the training and you have the perspective of a coach and you have the coach approach. So put it to work. And I did. And I started taking clients and charging right away. And actually this month is the year anniversary of opening my coaching practice.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
Well, and it's one of those things, I think there's a need, and it's why the great discontent succeeded. And it's why I think people latch on to this podcast and other ones like that, where we all have inspiration. There's plenty of places to gain inspiration from, and it's really hard to take action mm-hmm. because multitude of factors, whether it's your life situation or fear or, you know, creative insecurity or imposter syndrome or any of those things, it's really easy to get just caught up in that. Mm-hmm. And so to have someone there to kind of hold your hand through that is really valuable.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, and it's and what have you found? Were there parallels of working with the teens going through, you know, trauma to working with creatives now that you found mm-hmm. through this?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. A lot of the stuff I was doing as a social worker to provide support, I do now with my coaching clients. And you know, I think most of us, again, if you live long enough, you've experienced some kind of trauma. Mm-hmm. And creatives, you know, it's a non-traditional path. So there's so much uncertainty, and that can be really intimidating and scary. Yeah. And just having the support, you know, so I provide accountability. I provide a safe space to explore and discover and brainstorm and for people to speak their dreams aloud, right? Like, how many of us have dreams that we don't dare to speak, even to our friends, because we're afraid to be disappointed. We're afraid it won't happen. And so coaching is all about action. I help my clients take action. They move past inspiration, right?
Yeah.
To take action and create momentum in their lives. And it feels like magic, but it's not. It's just a lot of hard work. I had a client, this is the perfect analogy for those not familiar with coaching. I had a client tell me, oh yeah, I told my friends I was working with a coach and they asked me what you do. And I said, nothing. And we laughed. And I said, you're right. And she said, no, you do a lot. You nudge me, you provide resources, accountability, support, encouragement, but I do the work. And yeah. I said, that's exactly right. And you do the work in one area of your life and you realize that you're competent and you become confident and you can do it. And you can apply that to every area of your life, you know, whether it's work or personal or money or your physical health or your mental health, yeah. right? You can do the work. And it's so empowering to see people do the work. And I really, really love how, I don't know if I've found coaching or it's found me, but it just feels yeah. like such a great fit.
I mean, it's got to help you go through that as well. Mm-hmm. Like, I find that a lot of times if I give friends, you know, talking to people and giving them my perspective on things, it's a lot of times giving myself advice at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. No, the best coaches, the woman who trained our class told me that the best coaches are in process too, and that your clients don't expect you to show up and be perfect. They just expect you to be a person. And yep. so, yeah, part of my ongoing job as a coach is to be working on myself.
Yeah,
and I have done that, and you know, I'm really proud of the growth that I've experienced and everything I've done in the past 2 years. But I, you know, there's still so much more. We're always learning, always growing.
Yeah, and well, and I feel like since we've known each other, I did some writing before I started researching and doing writing these questions for today. And I realized, like, you started writing a column for the Working Out Working magazine, mm-hmm. Asking Not Asking. And even if it doesn't have to particularly pertain to what I'm going through, I get emotional every time I read it. And I figured out, I think, why, even like when I'm reading your poetry or your Medium articles or any of that, I almost every time get emotional, whatever you write. Mm-hmm. And I feel like maybe the feeling I get is that you're walking through the forest 50 feet ahead, mm-hmm. and you're shouting out the obstacles. And it gives me a sense of comfort hearing that, right? Yeah. And so it's like, okay, cool. Tina's got it. and so I'm following your journey, but it's also like a little bit of a precursor to my own journey, mm-hmm. Which is really nice to be able to connect to that.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. I'm gonna borrow that one. Yeah, you know, I think I was talking with, you know, I have a couple different mentors. Actually, two of my mentors are named Michael. I guess I don't know. And I was talking with the other Michael recently, and you know, I'm like talking about sequencing and how, you know, all the things I want to do and how do I build my business in the way I want to. And then he's like, well, what is this all about? And I said, well, you know, I was talking about writing and the opportunity to do the Asking Not Asking mm-hmm. column with Working Not Working, which has been incredible. And I thought, well, I feel like I'm here on earth to experience everything, right? Like the joy, the pain, the good stuff, the hard stuff, just experience it all and then give it back to the world in words. Because words are how I process. Like, I have so many journals from the past 2 years. I just cannot stop writing and processing. And if I can process through something I've experienced and give it back to the world in words, and that helps someone else, then it's worth it.
Yeah. Well, and I feel like it's very easy to feel like you're unique in your struggle mm-hmm. and unique in your pain. And when you go and either see something someone shared or you have a conversation, you see that other people go through it as well. It just mm-hmm. makes you feel so much better about whatever you're dealing with.
Yeah.
And it's nice to be able to, that there's people out there like you being able to share that, because I think it provides a space and a bit of comfort for people that are struggling with similar things.
Mm-hmm.
That's really great. Do you want to maybe explain a little bit more what asking not asking is and you know, what that's been all about?
Yeah, I would love to. So we're friends and we had breakfast, I don't know, was that like a year,
like
year and
January,
a half ago?
January, February this year, yeah. Like almost a year.
Oh, yeah. It hasn't even been a year. Okay, yeah. So we had this past winter, we had breakfast, we were catching up and talking about life and work, and you said, if you ever want to write for Working Not Working magazine, just let me know.
Yeah.
And I, now in my life, you know, when people offer and you think, well, they don't really mean it, or you don't feel like you deserve it, I think, if someone offers, I'm going to take them up on it. So if you make me an offer, I will be back to collect. and so I emailed you, I don't remember when, but it was like spring or summer, I think spring.
Yeah.
And I said, hey, Justin, I want to write for you. I'm coaching now.
Uh-huh.
How about a coaching column? We can solicit letters from readers and all of that. And you were like, cool, I'll connect you with, you know, the editor of the magazine, Mike.
Yeah.
And so Mike and I connected, hashed out an idea and brought it to life. And it's been really cool to have Working Not Working be the home for the column. You know, coaching is wonderful and I'm working with people one-on-one, but I think there's a much broader audience for the coach approach.
Yeah.
You know, I want to teach people the techniques and the tools that I share with my clients mm-hmm. because I think they're applicable to so many areas of our lives. And so, you know, I love that it's out in the magazine. There's no paywall. Anyone can read it and anyone can write to me and have a little bit of my time. And so people are writing to me anonymously using pseudonyms because they then can be very candid about their experience and really share in a wholehearted way, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm taking, you know, I'm drawing from experiences I've had from my time as a social worker, from my training as a coach, from the 6 years I spent interviewing creatives for The Great Discontent. I'm pulling on all of that knowledge to answer readers' questions. And these letters are just, you know, some of them are heartbreaking and so moving. And it just, again, you know, it's revealing the human condition and that we are all thinking about, you know, how our work, how can we do work that's sustainable, that sustains us both financially and at a soul level, right? And then like, how do we build our work and how do we build our lives and how do we do those things together in a way that's meaningful?
Yeah, and I think it's really easy to get into the habit of when you are a creative person and you're starting your career, or you're, you know, in the middle of your career, to just go with it, right? And mm-hmm. you're just like doing the things you feel like you have to do or you should be doing, or if I take a vacation, no one's ever going to hire me again when I come back, everyone's going to forget about me. And it's really easy to just get on that treadmill and then never get off. And then when you take those moments of pause and you go, oh, wow, I'm really unhappy or I'm frustrated or I don't know what to do next, it is a bit, you know, it's overwhelming. Mm-hmm. And so I think, I think the nice thing that you do as well is you answer these, you know, these really heartfelt letters. But the advice that you're giving is applicable to, you know, a lot of people in many different situations, mm-hmm. not necessarily specifically that situation. Because I think it dives in deep, then it also goes broad, which is really helpful as a reader to be able to say, oh, I can also relate to that or apply that thinking and whatever I'm going through right now.
Yeah.
Which has been really helpful.
Awesome. I'm so glad to hear it.
Yeah. It's been great. And I think it's one of those things, the creative community as a whole, I don't think has a lot. I think there's a lot that we struggle with
mm-hmm.
and it's why I started Overshare. But then also like I started, a creative support group a few months ago here in New York, called Talking, Not Talking. But the names, it gets really easy.
You have a great name. You have to use it.
Yeah, they get really easy.
Whenever you can.
Yeah.
You know, I have to say though, it's funny because Mike and I were trying to think of a name for the column and, you know, I named it Asking, Not Asking. I'm like, well, why don't we just stick with your brand and what you're already doing?
We try to avoid it at all costs and sometimes it just works so well.
It works.
Screw it. but it was basically like getting a room with 25 empty chairs mm-hmm. and saying like, who wants to come and talk about what they're struggling with? Because I just don't think there's not a lot of spaces to be able to do that and be able to share with vulnerability and be able to have the support of other people around you. And so to have what you're doing and then this and then talking, not talking and all of this stuff together, just creating space for people to just admit when they're having a hard time and raise their hand and not feel the pressure to take it all on themselves.
Yeah, I love that. And I know that that was a shift for you because of things that happened in your personal life where you wanted to be more open and have this opportunity for people to feel supported in that way. And that's, you know, that's why I wanted to do the column with you. That's why I love what you guys are doing in the creative community. You know, it's not just the online network, right?
You know, not just getting people jobs.
Exactly. You're not just getting people jobs. It's about quality of life too. And you really care and that shows and it's really incredible.
Thanks. Appreciate that.
Yeah.
What's surprised you in the letters you've received so far?
Oh, well,
if anything,
I think, you know, I just think people's honesty, because they're not using real names and some of them write to me with their real names and say, I'd like to remain anonymous. But really it's just a privilege to think that I can even answer these letters. Some of the situations that people are writing to me about, it's like, well, I don't know. I had someone who's, you know, midlife freelancer wrote to me and said, I'm midlife and I'm in debt and I don't know how I'm going to retire. And, you know, is this what I have to look forward to? And I thought, 2 years ago, I left my marriage with $4,000, and I'm also rebuilding. I'm also thinking about finances. But here's what I've experienced. Here's what I've learned. Here's where I'm taking cues from. Here's where I'm getting practical tips. You know, we're all in it together, and I think that's what, you know, you do so well through Working Not Working and all the support you provide. Like, we are all in it together, and so these letters are just reminding me that even though I don't have it all figured out, none of us do. I haven't been through all the situations that people are writing to me about, but we've all been through situations.
Yeah. And there's tools that to help you get through them.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is on one of your Instagram posts.
But
it was just like a really thoughtful, and you touched on this earlier, but it just said, this year I've learned that when I resist my reality, I prolong my own pain and suffering. If I accept it, and that doesn't mean I have to like it, then I can see my own choice.
Mm.
What do you mean by I can see my own choice?
Well, I think it means, you know, that's twofold for me.
Yeah.
You can see the choices that you've made that have gotten you into that reality, right? Even though there are often things that happen that are out of our control, there are things that are always within our control.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can see the choice you have moving forward. You can see the choice you have, you know, you can respond in many different ways. When I talk with coaching clients and, you know, for myself as well, you know, I like pizza. It's almost lunchtime. I'm hungry. So imagine you've got a pizza and there's like 8 slices is the optimal, right? So each slice is a choice. And sometimes we get into this thinking, well, I have to do this. I have to do that. When really you have many, many choices and you can order those slices in any order that you want, but you're choosing. And sometimes we tell ourselves we don't have a choice because we don't like the consequences of one of the choices, but it is still a choice. So I think just accepting, you know, this is my reality. No one is going to come save me. No one is going to come and say, here's an opportunity. I'm going to dig you out of this. No, I'm going to have to find the strength within myself. I'm going to have to reach out to people and ask for help. I'm going to have to maybe make some sacrifices for a little bit. I'm going to have to work hard. I'm going to do whatever I need to do to take responsibility for the choices I need to make to put my life back together.
But it's so much easier to pretend you don't have a choice and just sit there.
It is.
It's so much easier. It just feels shitty for a while.
It is and it isn't, because once you have awareness, then, you know, you're like, it's this constant energy drain, because in your mind you're like, I really need to do that. I really need to work on that. And, you know, people can go for years on the treadmill, right? And I think, like, sooner or later the treadmill is going to malfunction. And what I mean by that is life is going to happen. There's going to be a death or a divorce or a job loss or something. And so when you're living a life that is reactionary, I want you to wake up before that. With coaching, you know, I want people to have an awareness of the choices they're making and that they can make a different choice and that we can create our lives to look so many different ways. And so how do you want to create a life from the inside out based on what is important to you and what you value? versus reacting to what does my boss say I need to do? What are my family's expectations? What are all my friends doing? What does culture say, right? You know, all of those things, it's we're reacting to those all of the time. And on some level, you can't help but react. But you can also be very intentional about the life you build. And I think that is where if you want to be happy and build something sustainable, I think that is the place to come from.
Yeah. Well, and I found for myself that it was very easy to live habitually.
Mm-hmm.
And I just had habits and routines that I had had since childhood
mm-hmm.
that kept going. And they probably were in place to help me survive things.
Mm-hmm.
But they were working against me. When you want to be an adult and have a fulfilling life and have healthy relationships, those habits of maybe distracting myself,
mm-hmm.
of being a perfectionist, of trying to be an overachiever to prove my worth to other people, all of that stuff just becomes so easy to keep going in that those patterns, and to break those patterns takes a lot. So like if there's someone listening like right now and realizes that they've been living kind of in a way that they maybe don't want, like what's like a good first step?
Mm-hmm.
Or a question they should ask themselves to be able to get out of that.
Yeah. So the first thing, you know, I can say what you should not do.
Okay.
do not quit your life. Don't quit your job, your relationships, and your city and move and think you're going to start over, because wherever you go, there you are.
It's great to run away from things. Come on.
It works for a little bit. Then you have to run somewhere else. I'm a huge proponent of making small changes in your day-to-day, wherever you are, with whatever resources you have. So I would ask, you know, people who are listening that want to make a change, I would ask you, what do you want more of in your life or your work
mm-hmm.
or both? What do you want more of? What is keeping you from having more of that thing?
Mm-hmm.
And what is one thing you can do in the next week to have more of what you want in your life?
Yeah.
One thing. We all have 10 minutes.
Yeah.
We all have maybe an hour a week.
Yeah.
And, you know, take out your calendar, schedule in an hour in the next week that is only for you, and do something with it.
Yeah. Well, I think it's the more of, and then also the why.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think I would go and tell myself, yeah, well, I want to do more projects and I want to be more prolific. And then when you ask why,
mm-hmm.
and then you answer that question, and then you answer that question, you ask yourself why again, and you keep diving into those mm-hmm. whys, and then it gets down, you boil it down, and you're like, oh, that's why.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that when you understand your why, it probably changes some of those answers as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like I worked, Adam and I worked with a coach beginning this year, and she was amazing, and she just helped us identify what our own personal values are
mm-hmm.
and what motivates us. And mine were all about protecting people, entertaining people, having fun, being spontaneous, and then connecting with a lot of people, and then going back to childhood and why I feel the need to connect mm-hmm. and all that stuff. And it was like very eye opening to go, oh yeah, that's the stuff that motivates me.
Yep.
And that's the stuff that's important to me. And once I understood that, then I was like, well, yeah, this is what I should be doing. I should be doing more talks. I should be, you know, doing mm-hmm. connecting with people and creating a space to connect with people. And so it's really helpful to dive down into the why, because then you can make more informed decisions, as opposed to you're like, oh, yeah, well, I don't know. I want more money, you know? And it's like, well, why do you want more money?
Why do you want more money? Sense of security, right?
Yeah.
Or whatever it might be. Yeah, no, that's a great point.
It seems like you do, and this is just my own perspective, but it seems like you do a great job of embracing the unknown, which is a theme that keeps coming up over the past few months and through Talking Not Talking and all that. Like, we all are most of us are very terrified of the unknown. How do you look at it, and how do you approach that and be okay with it?
Oh, I don't know if I'm okay with it. you can be not okay with something and do it anyway. No, I would say, so my mother died when I was 10.
Mm-hmm.
She had a heart attack. It was very unexpected. That just left, you know, my world. You know, my dad had to take care of my brother and I. We're twins. He's developmentally disabled. Mm-hmm. I had to take on a lot of responsibility around the house, just because, you know, what else do you do? I was 10, but I was capable. And I think ever since then, you know, life prior to my mother passing away, you know, things felt safe. They felt consistent, secure. Yeah. There was a lot of, I don't know, just trust that the world was okay, right? Yeah. And then afterwards, it was like, oh, I've been duped. The world is not safe. You can't trust anyone. You can't open up because people will leave you whether they want to or not. Mm-hmm. And everything's out of your control. And so I think that my teenage years were in college and, you know, up until I got divorced, really was this exercise in wanting to control as much as I could. And part of that was, you know, controlling relationships through not being open or vulnerable, controlling, you know, work, controlling my marriage by trying to just like fixate on it and like put all my energy into it and make it the best it could be instead of actually working on myself, mm-hmm. right? There's so many things. And so, yeah, I tried to control everything. And then when I went through my divorce, it was like, oh, actually you can't control everything. And it's, you know, just not the best use of your energy. And so I think what I do now is maybe people would call it foolish, but I try to put myself in situations, not that are harmful, but situations where I can't control everything. Yeah. So I say yes to more things. Like I rarely did speaking before my divorce, just because I was like, I don't have anything to say. Uh-huh. I'm really scared. There's so many unknowns. I can't control how people respond to me. If I can't do it perfectly, I don't want to do it. Now I just get up on stage. I treat it as fun and play. If I make a mistake, whatever, do it next time. It's practice to me, right? Yeah. And so I say yes to things that I'm scared of. And I say yes to things where there are unknowns, and that's the only way to do it, you know? And also, you know, a mentor said this to me, and one of my Michael mentors, he said, not trying to control is also a form of control. So saying you don't, I don't care about anything, everything's cool, like I don't need to control anything, you know, that can also be a form of control by just saying you don't care. And
well, so it's also like a defense mechanism too.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so I want to kind of land in the middle where, you know, I'm not trying to control everything in my life, but I've got some things sorted out, but I'm also open to new opportunities that come my way. And I think I'm doing an okay job, but it's an ongoing process.
Well, I think for people who have grown up with a need to be in control or a need to be perfect, It's an unattainable goal, and it just leads to this tension and this frustration. Like I used to be a perfectionist about everything, and then it's just like then you get angry when things happen, and it's such a why do I need to do that? I'm like, well, because I need people to think I'm perfect. Well, like why do I need to do that?
Yeah.
And it's once you let go of that stuff, it's like, oh man, what a weight.
Yeah. Weight oh gosh, gone. You feel so much lighter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And even like when like giving talks, and I know there's a, you know, I used to want to give talks, and I know a lot of my friends want to give talks, and you do feel like, oh, I have to go up there and be perfect. And it's like, no, you just have to be yourself. Mm-hmm. Like my first talk I ever gave, my notes weren't, I spent like pulled two all-nighters the two nights in a row before it. And I had notes, like paragraphs of notes on each keynote slide. And when I got on stage, my notes weren't there, and it was just the screens were mirrored.
Oh, no. What did you do?
And I was like, does anybody have my notes? Can anybody fix this? And nobody came out to fix it. So I hit escape to try to fix it. And what it did is it brought it back into like, you know, edit mode. Mm-hmm. And my notes were there, and they were also reflected on the big screen behind me to 400 people. And the top line was all caps, bold, bright blue, words of encouragement from my dad, who's a motivational speaker.
Oh, okay.
And it said, breathe, slow down, strong voice, have fun.
Yeah.
And so it was like a 3-second delay, and then everyone started laughing. And I looked up and I'm like, oh shit. It was like slow mo. And I'm like, well, I guess we're going to do this. And I read like, breathe, slow down, strong voice. And people afterward thought I did it on purpose.
Oh,
and I was like, oh no, I was like on the verge of tears and ready to walk off stage. And so I was like, after that, I'm like, well, nothing could be worse than that.
Yeah.
And in hindsight, I went and looked back at the notes, and it was like legit paragraphs. Mm-hmm. If I had those notes, I would have been reading off of them, and I would have been so, and it was the want to feel smart or to like, you know, like it was a, you know, impressive crowd. And not want to embarrass myself. At the same time, you know what you're going to say. You know what you're talking about. And when you let go of that, like, oh my God, I need to make sure I say every word right. People don't remember the anecdote you forgot to say.
Yeah.
And you just like let go of that stuff. And you just like people, and I've heard like people don't remember what you say. They remember how you make them feel. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really, that's a good thing to remember. And it's like, you just go up there and you have fun. Other people are going to have fun too.
Totally.
Yeah. And then like, it's just, and now it's fun. Now I'm just like ridiculous when I give talks. I come out to like theme music sometimes.
Amazing.
Yeah.
When's your next talk? I'm going
to
be there.
I did one in Australia. I came out to Born in the USA because I was the only American speaker.
Nice.
But it's like, I was a mascot in my teen years. So I was like, I'm just tapping into that. It's cool. Coming out to entrance music. But it's one of those things like just letting go of whatever you expect a speaker to do. Or whatever you expect, you know, or you think people expect of you. Like, you can't control what people expect of you anyway, so just stop giving a shit.
You can't.
Yeah.
Agreed. Preach.
Let's see. What else we got here? I was going to ask, I'm fascinated by, like, sliding doors moments, like, mm-hmm. where you can make one decision or another, and it, like, severely impacts your trajectory in your life. Was there one moment in a decision you made that you think, like, sent your life in a completely different direction?
I really think it was going through my divorce.
Yeah.
I knew, like, in the moment that I knew my marriage was ending, there was just this voice in me that was like, you are about to be in the fight of your life. And that voice, it wasn't saying the fight of your life with
him,
your about to be ex-partner. It was mm-hmm. like the fight for your life,
mm-hmm.
to redefine yourself and figure out who you are, because I was so lost and I didn't know who I was. I was working all the time.
Yeah.
I didn't know who I was outside of my work. I didn't know who I was outside of my partnership. And I knew that I had a lot to figure out. But there was just this voice in me that was like, you are not going to go down in flames. You are not going to become a victim. You are going to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was a really pivotal moment, because I was just listening to a podcast. I can't remember the woman's name, but she was a Paralympic skier, and she only has one leg. And she was talking about skiing. When she skis, she doesn't use her prosthetic. She just skis on one leg, which is incredible. And she was talking about a race where, you know, she was slated to get the gold, and there was this like really slick, icy patch on the last curve. And she ended up getting bronze. And she was saying, you know, the woman... everyone was falling on this icy patch. And she said, the woman who beat me and got gold, even though I was rated as number one in the world, it's not that she didn't fall. She just got back up quicker. And I thought about that, because it's not that we don't fall. We all fall in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that we don't fall. It's that we get back up. And then it's how fast can we get back up? And it's not a race in that way. We're not going for gold and silver and bronze, but I just knew, I thought, I cannot take 3 years to get past this divorce.
Yeah.
I have to get back up, because I have some momentum going with my career, and I live in New York City, and I have so many things that I want for myself, and I refuse to sit out of the game for 3 years.
And it's easy to do that.
It is easy.
And I found myself in moments doing that. And sometimes you do need to sit with feelings, and you know, I think having a history of distracting myself from feelings, it's good for, you know, a couple weeks maybe.
Yeah.
But then you got to get back up. Yeah. That's such a great lesson there.
Yeah. No, you need to give yourself time. I think the whole first year, especially the first 6 months and the first three, I was like a zombie, but I gave myself time. But I knew, I was like, girl, when it's time, you're getting back in that game. You're going to say yes. You're going to speak. You're going to do your work. Mm-hmm. You're going to be you, and you're going to put yourself out into the world and tell your story. And I just always knew that I was going to do those things.
Yeah. I read in your bio, I was reading your website now, and it's just your bio, and mm-hmm. it has a couple links, and it's really nice, and it's really thoughtfully done. And I love that you gave a talk at Howe about how your mission now is to abandon the hustle and embrace contentment,
mm-hmm.
Which is such a nice counter to where you were. And I feel like it's so easy to be dissatisfied and to want something other than what we have. I ask people, like, do you feel like your ambition gets in the way of your happiness?
Mm.
Like, do you feel like that now, or do you think at some points it has?
I think in the past my ambition got in the way of my happiness, because it led me to be so future focused that I couldn't be present.
Yeah.
It was like destination disease, right? You're like, when I just reach this point in my career, or when I just get this speaking opportunity, or when I just make this much money, or when I sell this many magazines, And then you get to that and you metabolize it, right? And then you need to do the next thing. And you won't let yourself be happy until you do this thing and then that thing. And
it
then
it keeps moving.
And yeah. then you die and you're never happy. Yeah. And but I do believe that we can be ambitious and content at the same time. And I have many things I want to do in my life, but I'm also so grateful for the opportunities I've had. And, you know, one of the things that I do, I journal on a regular basis and I'll keep lists, you know, gratitude lists, right? Like, yeah. what am I thankful for in this moment?
It's the key to everything.
And it sounds so simple and maybe it sounds woo-woo, but it really shifts the way you view your world and what you focus on. It's like when you buy a new car and then you see that model, you see that make of car on the street everywhere. It's not that they're everyone's driving that car now. It's just that's what you're focused on. That's what you're yeah. tuned in to see. And that's what gratitude does, where you start thinking about the things you're thankful for, and then you begin to see more to mm-hmm. be thankful for, and you begin to see more opportunities. And so I think you can be ambitious and content. You know, people think about contentment as they equate it with being lazy or lethargic, and I don't
or settling,
at all.
Yeah. yeah,
or settling. And I just think if you are hustling and you've bought into this idea that you can't ever relax or take a break, like, that's your choice. But who is going to be retiring at, you know, 65 or at all? We are all going to work very long careers if we're lucky enough to, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, you have to, that has to be sustainable. And I don't think that is. I don't think the hustle is sustainable.
No. And it burns you out. And mm-hmm. and a lot of times you're doing that hustle for other people and not for mm-hmm. yourself.
Exactly.
Do you feel like you have something to prove?
Oh, I mean, yeah, I think to myself, just as a woman, as a woman who was in a partnership for a very long time and who grew up in the Midwest with messaging about what opportunities are available to women, mm-hmm. I really do want to have a certain level of success. And I want to be fulfilled with my work, but I also want to, you know, my finances are like, this is the thing I'm fixated on right now. I've been listening to a lot of podcasts about women and money mm-hmm. because money was the thing I was most scared of before. And in my marriage and business, I did not manage the finances. And yeah. that's partly because it's really hard to have two people digging their hands into the money. And it was easier for me to just put the blinders on and be yeah. like, you know, not that I was never involved in money decisions. I just day to day wasn't managing. Right. And so when I had to manage my money, I was like, well, shit.
Yeah,
I just felt like I didn't even know where to start. And so, yeah, I want to be competent in all the areas of my life and feel like I'm doing the work that I'm here to do and investing in myself in the way I want to. I do feel like I have something to prove, but maybe not to other people as much as to myself that yeah. I can do this.
Well, when you say be successful, how do you define success?
Oh gosh, it's so, success is such a subjective thing.
For sure.
I think for me it means having the resources to do the work that I want to do, and then having that work be financially sustainable, right?
Yeah.
So it's a mix of like practical and yeah. and dreamer.
Yeah, that's good. What excites you these days?
Well, I had a passport for 10 years and I had one stamp in it, and I renewed my passport this past February and I have many, many stamps in it.
Oh, wow.
Been to a lot of places, and travel really excites me because it gets me out of my routine and gives me perspective and allows me to experience the world through, you know, different cultures and yeah. food and landscapes. And I really love that.
Yeah. That's amazing. Since February. You've
yeah.
had that many. That's great. Yeah. What's been your proudest moment?
I think when my marriage ended, my family was like, oh my gosh, are you going to move back to Michigan? Are you going to be okay? What do you need? And I said, I'm going to be fine, and I'm going to stay in New York because my community is here and my opportunities are here. So I'm really proud of the life I've created for myself here, and that I've stayed in New York, and that I've done the things that I said I was going to do.
Yeah, that's exciting. You should be proud of that. What do you want to do that you haven't done yet?
Oh, I want to write a book.
Okay.
Yeah. That's easy. I want to write many books.
Many books. Writing a note on that. All right, cool. I'm going to hold you to that.
Okay.
What's your biggest fear?
I think it goes back to what I was just saying about money. Just like not knowing what to do with it, not being a good steward of it, like not making enough money, right? Because growing up with a bit of a scarcity mentality, it was always like, well, I just won't think about the money and then it won't be an issue, but I have to think about it and I need to and I want to. And I've been using a budgeting app and been like purposefully taking look at
which
money.
Budgeting app?
It's called Every Dollar. Now, it's Dave Ramsey and I don't love everything he preaches, but what I like about the app is that you get to budget for every category and then you put in all of your I put all my transactions in manually. I don't tie it to my bank because that makes me look at everything I'm spending.
Oh, wow.
And then it tells you what you have remaining in that category.
Oh, that's
so
cool.
It's been helpful.
I should probably do that.
It's been very helpful. Yeah.
Yeah. What's your Achilles heel as a creative person?
Procrastination.
Yeah, me too.
Mm-hmm.
I
think
it's
so many
easy.
Of us would say that. It's so easy.
Yeah, I want to get past that. Maybe I'll make that my goal this year. I was going to say, are there any ways you self-sabotage? But I'm guessing it's probably procrastination.
Yeah, procrastination. I think that's number one.
Yeah. Have you figured out any tricks to help you get past it or to deal with it?
I think, I work for myself. So there's this fantasy of, I work for myself. I have so much flexibility. I have all the time in the world.
Yeah.
But what happens when we have no structure is we procrastinate and then we think, I have so much time. And so structuring my days and actually putting everything into my calendar that I need to do has been helpful. And then just giving myself deadlines, you know, like maybe I procrastinate.
It's really hard to do when you're working for yourself.
It is hard to do. But you have to give yourself some kind of incentive or deadline.
Yeah. When I get these three things done, then I can go and watch one episode of Maniac on Netflix.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or you say like, you really like, I'm a big snacker. So I like to get up and go raid the cupboards. And I'm like, okay, you have to write two more paragraphs with this working, not working column. Or you have to get your first draft done and then you can go have a snack.
Yeah.
And I know it's like, no one's making me sit at the desk, but
it's almost parenting yourself.
It is parenting yourself. It's like that discipline and grit and tenacity.
Yeah. Yeah. That's helpful. Who makes you jealous?
Who makes me jealous? I think that I've started over at an age where I wish I wasn't starting over, right? So I think there is definitely temptation to compare myself to my peers who have been in their career path longer or who just haven't gone through a major transition, right? It feels like they have a little more stability. They're a little further ahead financially. And so that's challenging sometimes. And I just have to remind myself, like, look, you didn't plan for it, but this is where you are and you're going to make the best of it.
Yeah. And you can't hold yourself to this unrealistic timelines or deadlines or anything else that you have no control over.
Yep. Agreed.
Do you have a nemesis?
A nemesis? No, that's not how I roll. Maybe like a dark chocolate. Like
a constant battle with dark chocolate.
Yeah.
Do you have any regrets?
Of course. I mean, if I said no, I wouldn't be human. I wish I would have pursued a creative path earlier. You know, maybe there are things in my marriage I wish I would have done differently, of course. I wish I would have been more vulnerable with friends and created deeper friendships earlier on. Mm-hmm. You know, many, many things, but I can't, you know, you can't play the what if game. But I can ask myself that to know in the future the things that I want.
Yeah. Well, I've had moments where I was going to Al-Anon meetings and I was like, I wish I had come here sooner.
Yeah.
And there's a guy in his 60s and he's like, you're way ahead of the game.
Yeah.
He's like, how old are you? I'm like, 36. And he's like, I didn't start coming here until I was 50.
Wow.
And so it's like, you only know what you know and you only know when you're ready for it. Yeah. And it's okay whenever it happens. And we can't say, I wish I had done this sooner because then maybe you wouldn't have been ready for that.
Yeah.
You know,
and you know, it's like we're getting very existential now, but it's the question of if I had done things differently, would I be on the same path?
Yeah.
You know?
And everything that happened the way it happened got you to here. And if you're happy with where you are now, then you can't really do anything differently.
Exactly.
Are you happy?
I am happy.
Okay. And finally, how are you feeling right now?
I'm feeling actually quite relaxed. It feels like we just had a little therapy session. It was very cathartic for me. I didn't cry, but...
I didn't cry either, to put it on record. I didn't cry.
You didn't,
I felt it,
yeah,
but
no
tears.
No physical tears.
No physical tears. We'll save those for later. Tim, thank you so much.
Thank you, Justin.
It's been great. Yay. We did it, Gabby.
Tina, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. I have a newfound hope and enthusiasm for making room and letting the universe fill it. If you enjoy this overshare, please let us know. We would love to hear from you. You can send us a message on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook at Overshare Talks. Also, subscribe to ensure you get our future episodes when they're released every 2 weeks. And of course, rate and review us to help other people discover Overshare. Thanks to the team at Second Child for hosting us in their beautiful studio in Droga 5 in New York City. Thanks to our audio engineer, Martin Keating, to Working Not Working's own Gabby D'Amato for editing this episode. The Overshare theme song is Let It Grow by Caleb Grow. And if you'd like to learn more about Working Not Working and join as a creative or to hire amazing creatives, check us out at workingnotworking.com. That's all we've got for this episode. See you next time.